KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
For having me. And thank you for supporting my deputy in filling my role last week when I had a conflicting meeting on Tuesday. So thank you for that as well. Well, I can go ahead and get started if that makes sense in the meeting. On the COVID front, by and large, good news. We're continuing to see case rates and hospitalizations decrease nationwide. Deaths are also starting to decrease, though we are still seeing approximately 1,800 deaths a day due to COVID-19 in the country. And I think that's important to keep in mind as we see decreases. They are from really shocking highs of late. And so we're still seeing quite a bit of transmission, quite a bit of hospitalizations and deaths, unfortunately. But they are moving in the right direction. We are starting to see a little bit of variability in that descent around the country. So the parts of the country that have lifted their mandates earlier or didn't have any mandates at all are starting to see their cases plateau or in some states actually start to rise again. And so we are watching that very carefully. That is something, unfortunately, that we did anticipate. We really, as we've talked about, we go up these peaks and valleys and we really need to get to the valley before we lift our mandates. Otherwise, we tend to see a rebound in cases. And so that's what we are working on here. We are moving in the right direction, but we do want to see those case numbers get to a safer space before we lift the mitigation measures that are helping make that trend happen. In Washington as a whole, we are also seeing cases decline, but we are starting to see that case decline slow. That's just started in the last week, so we're watching that. I think some of that is around kind of this general feeling of wanting to go back to normal sooner rather than later, and some parts of our state are relaxing their restrictions faster than others and faster than we would frankly recommend. In Jefferson County, our case rates are improving. So our total number of cases right now is 3,066. That puts our case rate at 525 per 100,000 as of Friday. We do calculate that weekly. Our percent positivity is improving, though still high at 13%. And we have four of our residents currently hospitalized for a total of 111 hospitalizations in this response. We have lost 27 of our residents to COVID-19. No new deaths over the weekend. In Clallam County, our total number of cases is 10,757. Our case rate in Clallam has actually dipped a little bit below Jefferson at 450 per 100,000. I think that's more a matter of how frequently we calculate that. I anticipate Jefferson would be in a similar space if we were calculating daily. And we can consider updating that a little more frequently this week as case rates drop, just so that we can monitor that transition a little bit more quickly. I think the biggest news was on Friday when the CDC updated their masking guidelines. I think that many of us in the public health community knew they were considering that update, but we didn't know the details of it until the rest of the public heard them as well. I can say that I think that the combination of considering hospitalizations and case rates is an appropriate transition. However, the case and hospitalization thresholds set by the CDC are incredibly high, and I do believe dangerously high. They're about twice the thresholds that were set in Washington state. So they're looking at a 10% a 10 per 100,000 hospitalization rate, whereas in Washington, we were looking at a 5. And they're also looking at 200 cases per 100,000 in a 7-day range. So roughly equivalent to the 400 cases per 100,000 that we look at here on a 14-day range. I do think those thresholds are too high. I think stopping masking at that high of a threshold really does increase the probability that you either see a plateau or a resurgence of COVID-19 infections. And so I am glad that our mask mandate for the state is still in place at this time. I do note that there is a press briefing for the governor this afternoon that could potentially involve discussions of the mask mandate, but I don't know the details on that yet. I I do think that however the mandate goes, my recommendation is that we as a community continue to mask indoors until our case rates get to a safer threshold. And roughly the case threshold that I think would be reasonable to stop masking indoors would be a case rate of less than 100 per 100,000 over a 2-week period. That is a much safer threshold for to stop masking in indoor spaces. So whether or not it's required, I really encourage us to keep those masks on a little bit longer. I think that will do a lot to keep this positive trajectory going and to keep us moving into that safer space so that we don't prolong the challenges that we have been facing and we don't see a significant resurgence of infections. When we do lift the mask mandates, in addition to recommending masks generally, I strongly recommend high quality masks for those who are at high risk of severe disease. So if you have underlying medical conditions, if you're over 65, really, really important that you have a high quality mask. So a KN95 or a KF94 or a full N95, if you can tolerate that, that's going to be really important in indoor spaces. It's also important to remember that any of us who are unvaccinated are still at high risk of severe disease. And so we would recommend that those who have not gotten vaccinated wear a high quality mask when in indoor spaces. That includes children. Children generally, luckily, do not have as severe of disease due to COVID-19. However, some children are at higher risk. So unvaccinated kids with underlying medical conditions, particularly things like asthma or Down syndrome, actually really put kids at high risk of severe disease. So it's important that those kids get vaccinated as soon as possible, especially before any mask mandates are lifted, and that they wear a high quality mask when indoors. I would also encourage those of us who have interactions with those high risk groups to continue to wear a high quality mask indoors as well to protect those in our life. So with that, I am happy to take any questions from the commissioners.
I have lots of questions today, given that there's no KPDZ questions, especially. So a few on masking, if we could dive in there. So would you recommend, so we got a notification of the governor's press conference this afternoon as well, which is about indoor masking. Mm-hmm. If indeed he were to say that he plans on revoking the mask mandate sooner, which I'm not sure if that's what you're suggesting, but are you suggesting that we might consider deviating from the state's plan if they were to revoke the state mandate sooner?
Good question. I think it depends on how much sooner. I think March 21st is a reasonable date. I think we're on track to be at those safe case thresholds by that time. I think if it's just a little bit sooner, it would be reasonable for the mandate to be revoked, but I still would really encourage all of our citizens to continue to mask indoors. If it's, tomorrow, then I would recommend that we deviate from the state on our mask mandate just to keep our citizens safer a little longer. I hesitate to do that. I think these decisions are best made at the state level. It's best if we travel as a group when it comes to these mandates. But I am concerned if we lift this too soon. And however it goes, I do really encourage the rest of us keep masking at least until the 21st. I think that would be, we would all be safer the more of us voluntarily continue masking indoors.
I was kind of incredulous on Friday, mostly getting, the CDC announcement was a surprise to me, but I'm not nearly as in touch as you are with the machinations of state and federal, but I couldn't believe that Seattle Times reporting was awful. They kept putting out news alerts and articles about, masks, CDC saying masks are no longer required without mentioning that Washington State still has a mask mandate.
Oh no.
And then even, I had to take a screenshot of it. I was so amazed. It said the CDC no longer advises people to mask indoors. I mean, not just like a mandate is ending, but we don't advise people to mask. And it was just shocking. And I was emailing with our public health department to say, am I the only one losing my mind over here? It sounds like there was consternation statewide about this, but yeah. Was that a shared opinion that was messaged really poorly.
Yes. No, I share that opinion. The exact date that it was going to be released was a surprise to us, and the exact nature of it was a surprise to us. And I think, unfortunately, what we're seeing with the CDC guidance change is a problem we've seen before. It's we do these massive pendulum swings. We go from it's required always everywhere to I guess you don't need it anymore. And that's very confusing. And I think the public, by and large, finds that that doesn't make sense. Because it doesn't. We really should have a much more gradual transition between these things. And so I think what would be reasonable is going from required to recommended, and then going from recommended to recommended for a group of high-risk folks to not recommended. And I do think that the science supports that transition. And so I try not to differ from the CDC unless I absolutely have to, but this is a place where I do differ from them. I think that masks are absolutely still recommended in indoor spaces. One interesting point, though, is that they do break us down by high-risk status, and Clallam and Jefferson are still high-risk, even under these metrics, and so they are still recommended indoors here. One quick update, if you look at the state map, is much of the state hospitalization data is somehow not getting properly transmitted to the feds, and so you'll see some parts of the state that have surprisingly low COVID risk. That is a data error. Much of the state is still in at least high or moderate risk. But yes, I recommend masking indoors. And I think this is unfortunately just another case of the CDC swinging a little too hard and not properly conveying the data in front of us, which is that I do think it's reasonable in a few weeks to transition from requiring masks to recommending them. And that's what we'll plan on doing here. And then as we see our case rates continue to drop, to recommending them for high-risk groups. I think that is an appropriate, smooth transition and the one that is most consistent with the data in front of us.
So I'm a policy nerd, and I'm really interested in that kind of conversation about how do you message things and create policy that's going to have the impact you're looking for and human behavior. And so seeing this play out in my own family, and it seems like people are falling into a camp of like, it's easier to just tear the Band-Aid off. Like, let's just stop wearing masks. And, if the risk indeed is not very high, like it's going to be hard. It's we have to relearn how to interact indoors. A lot of teenagers don't like their face showing. They liked the privacy of that. There's some strange human dynamics that are kind of coming into play right now. And then I think some folks are interested in a much more gradual move away. And even, so for example, in my family, where we have enough masks now where we can test before we get together, so it feels relatively safe doing that. It's still interesting to see, like, when we choose and who's comfortable with leaving masks on and taking them off. And I think that's kind of the gradual nature you were saying you wish the CDC would do. I think it applies to humans too. Like, so any suggestions? I mean, I think we've talked all along about the need to be doing a personal assessment of risk and applying that, but when the CDC is saying masks are no longer required, How do we kind of move into doing that comfortably again? And when is that safe?
Sure. So I think a couple of things to know. I think I do empathize, as much as I disagree with the move they made, I do empathize with the position the CDC is in. There is a ton of political pressure on public health entities to kind of get in line with the political whims of the day. I just wish more public health agencies would stand up to that pressure. And I think this, unfortunately, was a bit of a capitulation rather than a true data-driven decision. I do think at this time, it's still recommended for all of us to wear our masks indoors. As we move into a safer range, likely mid to late March, then what I would say is still not required, but recommended for all of us, but especially for those of us who are high risk themselves or closely interact with people who are high risk. So what does that mean? So if you're over 65, have underlying medical conditions, we do still recommend you mask indoors. Or if you have unvaccinated people in your life who are high risk, then we still recommend you mask indoors. So you guys have interacted on this call before with the fact that I have a two-year-old. She's unvaccinated because that's not an option for her. So I'm going to still keep being very careful in my life so I don't bring anything home to her. And I think it's important for all of us to think about our household contacts. If you live with someone who is high risk of death due to COVID-19, either because they can't get vaccinated yet or have chosen not to, or because they have underlying significant medical conditions, it's a good idea for you to also be cautious in your life, because often we are how that virus gets into our homes. So thinking about your household contacts and your own risk is really some of the most important parts. And then also considering the needs of the people around you. So one of the kind of more heartening things that I've been hearing is I have been getting messages from kids around the lifting of the mask mandate in schools. And some of them are very, very sweet about the fact that they know they've got kids in their class who are high risk. And so they're going to just keep masking because they want to protect that person. And I think considering the other people in your office, in your classroom, and their risk, and getting more comfortable having that conversation, saying, hey, man, I've got asthma. I'm worried about it. Can we keep masking in this space? And really have those kind of respectful, open discussions about your risk. I think that will go a really long way. And then I think the only other thing I would add to that is remember that you cannot always see a person's risk. Not all of us present with our risks on our sleeves. And so if you see a person who is still maintaining even more stringent masking than we are saying for the public, there's probably a reason for that. It might be their own personal comfort, but it also might be that they actually have a cancer history that you don't know about, or they've got someone at home who's really high risk and they're doing everything they can to protect them. So let's please be understanding of each other. There's lots of good reasons to mask indoors and just support each other in that as much as we can.
Thank you. I'll stop dominating questions now.
I had many of the same questions, and I guess I'm wondering, just a little bit more of the risk calculation on a community level versus a personal level, because we're all doing that, right? And as you know, I've got the hybrid immunity right now, so I'm feeling a little invulnerable, but I'm also happy to think about what's best for the public health and to mask indoors. It doesn't cause me any heartache or anything. I guess I'm wondering if we should start modeling these conversations, because I think, you know, assessing individuals' risk and in the context of the fabric of society as well is something that I find myself doing in almost every in-person gathering that I do, whether it's a small meeting that we all of a sudden are doing in person, but it's just that kind of conversation and negotiation is something that I think is going to become part of society now. And I'm just wondering if we could, you know, maybe get ahead of the curve on this one.
Sure. So yeah, there are a couple of things you consider. The simplest one is your community case threshold. And so that's all those case rates that we keep talking about. And that the reason why we focus on that one so much is that really gives you the probability that anyone in any space has COVID. And so if that number gets really low, no matter your personal experience of vaccination or not, you still are unlikely to carry COVID because we just don't have that much around. That's not the case right now. We do still have a lot around. And so that probability is still relatively high. There are some risk calculators that I think we're going to be sharing soon from the Public Health Department webpage so that you can actually just go in and say, all right, I'm going to a gathering with 50 people. What's the probability that one of those people has COVID? And you might be surprised at how high it is right now. So being able to kind of weigh that can be helpful if you're mathematically inclined. I think having the kind of dials of low, medium, and high risk would be helpful as well. So we'll start updating that kind of thing, but that's all community level. It is true that each of us have different interpersonal risks. So myself, I'm boosted. And I'm young. If I didn't have a kid at home who's unvaccinated, I might be more comfortable taking more risks. Similarly, Commissioner Brotherton, you've been public about your status of being vaccinated and having unfortunately had a breakthrough. So being willing to share that with the people in your room. So when I have a gathering, I do still keep them pretty small, but if I'm gonna meet up with say four of my friends and we're gonna meet up indoors, I say, all right, are we all boosted? Like, let's talk this through. Let's make sure we all have similar risk, and just normalize having that conversation, and having it respectfully. so that if you have a friend who says no, that you can have that conversation about risk of like, okay, cool, totally understand, but let's move this one outside, or let's add masks and not have food inside, you know, have those kind of variations. The things you can do to increase your protection is getting vaccinated and boosted and making sure the other people are. It's adding masks or moving it outside. Those are all the ways that you can decrease the risk in the room and still find a way to interact closely with your friends.
Can I add one thing to that? And that's just, yeah. I think there's on both sides a lot of stigma that goes with the other side right now.
Yes.
Not that there's two sides of society or anything, but you know, the more that we can do to, I mean, both share it and try not to be judgmental as we assess that risk calculus for ourselves and the groups that we're in, I think the better we'll get through this, because it's not just our physical health that I'm concerned about. It's our ability to be in the same space with each other again. And I feel that's been damaged in the last couple of years by the pandemic as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. We have to learn how to work together. And so that includes, you know, having meetings with folks who have different vaccine status than you, and how do you make that as safe as possible? And I always remind folks, we do, you know, in the medical profession, we've been doing this for a while. I've been, throughout the pandemic, I've been seeing patients who have COVID, either in the clinic or in their home, and I've not gotten COVID. And the way that I do that is I wear a very high quality mask. So it is possible to protect yourself adequately. I'm vaccinated, I'm boosted, I wear a good mask, and I don't get COVID. So please don't fear each other too. I have had that sometimes where people say, you know, I just can't get together with my friend because she's unvaccinated. You can, but you need to step up your protections. So that means either meet outside, we don't see transmission of COVID outside, or add a good high quality mask and encourage your friend to mask as well. And then you can still be friends and you can still hang out indoors. It's not one or the other.
I'll ask, changing the subject. You know, we were exhorted again today to do our own research. And as you know, of course, we do our own research as well. And reading over the weekend about some studies about the origin of COVID-19, I read about some studies that have said it did come from the market. It wasn't a lab created bioweapon. And I was wondering if you could speak to the efficacy of those studies, if you have any information.
So there's definitely still kind of ongoing exploration of the source of COVID, but the most likely source that we've seen at this point is an animal reservoir, is that it was in an animal population and then it transitioned into humans. And that's a common thing we've seen in pandemic viruses. So pandemic flu also usually comes from an animal reservoir. What happens is it's able to mutate while it's in the animal, and then it gets a mutation that allows it to transmit to humans. And that's really the by far most likely source. In this case, the only major debate is which animal reservoir. And there are actually a couple options. Snakes and bats are two of the most likely ones for where this came from. We've also, since the COVID pandemic has happened, we've found a couple other reservoirs in deer and rodents. But the most likely source is animals. That's the best that I can say there. And I think the only other thing that I would share is that this hyper-focus on kind of finding the source of COVID mainly seems to come within kind of a desire to place blame for the pandemic on someone, as opposed to what it really is, which is just a terribly unlucky virus. We were all unlucky to have been around at the moment that a pandemic happened, and there will be more. That will continue to happen. Viruses and bacteria mutate all the time. Luckily, these don't tend to happen very frequently. The last one was about 100 years ago, but I do hope that we learn from this pandemic how to be more prepared for the next one.
And of course, as civilization pushes into wild areas, we will have more contact with animals and probably more zoonotic diseases spreading into the human population, right?
Yeah, so the increase in pandemics is directly correlates with movement into wild areas and global warming. So some of the bugs that are most known for spreading nasty pathogens can now travel much further north because it's warmer. So the mosquitoes that can carry problematic viruses, ticks, are spreading to new places, and we are moving into wild places. So one of the early studies into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic involved looking at tribes that live very near caves where there are bats, and that they were seeing was frequent introductions of coronaviruses from those bats. And so as we move more and more into wild areas, we are unfortunately going to see more of that. And I think that should hopefully serve as a call to action to do work on limiting global warming and deforestation, and to be really thoughtful about our planned communities.
Great. Sorry, I'm going to keep going with free range questions since we don't have any KPTZ.
Yeah, questions. we have time.
great. So I guess now I forgot because I prepped it. I forgot. Oh, well, I have one other one too. And that's just, I wanted to tell you, I did have a meeting with Peter Rhines, who's worked with the DEM and the schools before. And we're trying to come up with some sort of clean air program and have a chamber cafe and do a little prescriptive pilot project on two local businesses to see if we can't create a tool set for small businesses to be able to understand their ventilation profile and adjust it to be safer in the face of, airborne infectious diseases specifically.
Right.
That's fantastic. And there is I don't know if you guys have already come across, King County made a good toolkit for indoor air quality. And so I think that could be potentially a template for what we use out here. The other key thing to remember there is it doesn't just decrease your risk of COVID, it decreases your risk of other viruses and improves air quality when it comes to smoke. And so preparing for that is all good. As we move into lifting mask mandates, especially in schools where our rates of vaccination are some of the lowest, I'm really encouraging our schools to look into improving ventilation, both modifying HVAC systems, but also you can make very simple box fan
and a MERV filter.
Yeah, it works, and it makes a huge difference. And so especially for classrooms where you have high-risk children, so kids with special educational needs, I'm strongly encouraging adding one of those because it will make a huge difference in reducing infections in that population.
How many people die per day from the flu in the U.S.?
Very, very few, even on a normal year. But right now, we have had a total of 4 diagnosed flu infections in Clallam and Jefferson County combined. And so I think that's the other simple data point for the efficacy of the things that we've been doing. We don't see the flu right now, and that's mainly due to masking. That's made that happen. And so they do work, they do help, but we've seen a fraction of the flu cases and deaths in the last 2 years.
And it's, even a normal year, still Omicron even is not the flu.
Yes, yeah, even in a normal year, flu has never killed 1800 people a day. Usually what we see in a bad flu year is up to 20 to 50,000 people die in the United States for a bad flu year, not the 950,000 people that we've lost so far due to COVID-19. It's just it's a worse virus.
And we heard comments today too about, how people being unvaccinated, has led to unnecessary deaths, which I think is true. And also to the development or to the evolution of Omicron. And I guess to me, Omicron's existence seems to be because we did not vaccinate the world well enough and we didn't equitably distribute vaccine. And it doesn't seem like that was the take rate was the issue, but just the fact that you had such a low vaccination rate in an entire country because of access to the vaccine.
Yes, so the virus will always mutate, but it will mutate much faster when it has uncontrolled spread. So when it's just running through a population, and the way that that happens by and large is if you have large populations who are unvaccinated, and we have not done a good job globally with vaccination. Both, we didn't distribute vaccine. So we distributed vaccine to the globe about 6 months later than we distributed it here, which was a bad idea. And then we distributed a vaccine that is not heat stable and with very little support for distribution. And so that's the biggest thing that's limited uptake in the rest of the world. There has been some vaccine hesitancy in parts of the world, primarily exported from the United States. So when we interact with our global partners around this, the most common thing that we see is that the same vaccine hesitancy in the global South is from sharing memes that originated in the United States. So that is an export that I regret that we have exported to the rest of the world. But mostly the biggest challenge is still access.
Great. Thanks for entertaining my all over there questions.
No, those are great. One other point I realized I wanted to make earlier, whenever these mask mandates do get lifted, they do not apply to healthcare settings. So it is still required to wear a mask in a healthcare settings, not just for the workers, but also for visitors. So if you are coming into a clinic, it is required that you wear a mask. We have unfortunately started seeing some folks starting to unmask in clinical settings. And I've been requested to remind everyone that we do still have to wear masks in clinical settings. And we will have to much past March 21st.
Thank you. I had one comment, reflection. I shared earlier that over the weekend, I spent quite a bit of time reflecting that we are at the 2-year point of the first death from COVID in the United States, which was in Western Washington. And, I remember I was thinking back everything that's happened in my life in the last 2 years. And early in during the pandemic, there was a dear friend of mine who contracted COVID on a trip to Portugal, and has long hauler, has long-term respiratory and muscular impact from the pandemic, from COVID. And I'm amazed at the number of people who think that you might get it, it'll go away. There are people in our community who are permanently affected by the virus. And it also made me reflect on my personal experience on my honeymoon 21 years ago, when I contracted Japanese encephalitis. Mm-hmm. And because I went to the vaccination center at the UW, and they didn't recommend, based on my itinerary for our trip in Indonesia, that I get that vaccine. But maybe we went off our plan a little bit. Maybe we went out into the, farmland a little bit more than we should have. But it made me really start thinking about the impact of personal decisions. And, I know I've said over the course of the last year, it's all of these are personal decisions. I support personal decisions. I still support personal decisions. And it's, maybe I should have decided to get that vaccine at that moment. I should have, because that was a really awful experience in life. But it's just interesting to think about kind of the larger, the not this week impacts of the pandemic or of a virus, and how it can really affect your life for a very, very long time. And I just don't want to see people in our community getting that sick.
Thank you for sharing that. It is a challenge, I think, largely related to this big misinformation push to try to minimize how severe COVID is. And for many of us, it is not that severe, especially if we're vaccinated. But for about 5 to 10% of cases, they get prolonged symptoms much long after it. Difficulties with respiration, difficulties with kind of endurance, fatigue, and cognitive issues. So that kind of brain fog issue, which can really be very serious and detrimental. And it is a real disorder. I think that's the other challenge, is that people who have long haulers or prolonged COVID symptoms often feel dismissed, that they may be just, not tough enough. It's a very real thing. There's lab findings associated with it. So signs of chronic inflammation in their body, and signs of autoimmunity. So we think it's mostly a trigger of an autoimmune disorder. in these folks who get prolonged symptoms after COVID-19. The other thing that I think is not often talked about enough is we see significant prolonged mental health impacts of contracting COVID-19. So particularly in children, increased rates of depression and anxiety after COVID-19 infection that persist long after they recover. Primarily, we believe this is actually related to the neurological inflammation that comes with COVID-19 that's leading to some of these symptoms. So it's a very real, very serious illness. It's very much worth preventing. We do have the tools to prevent serious illness. Your risk of long COVID, your risk of severe disease is dramatically reduced by getting vaccinated. And I would really encourage any of us who hasn't yet to go forward and get vaccinated, get that booster, especially parents as we talk about kids. I do think we have in some ways been a victim of our own success. We've done an incredible job protecting our schools. We have really reduced transmission in our school settings. And so I think we have unfortunately given the impression that kids can't get COVID. They can, and that risk is going to increase when we unmask in school settings. And so the best way to protect your kids is to get them vaccinated and to encourage them to wear a high quality mask when the mask mandates come off.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. I'm sitting here looking at Willie thinking he probably thought, no KPTC questions. I'm going to get lots of minutes on Monday. Well, if there are no more questions for Dr. Berry, I will turn the floor over to Willie.
I do have another question for Dr. Berry, but it can wait until after Willie's report to be sure to give him enough time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I don't need a whole heck of a lot of time today, though, since, you know, we are ramping down our COVID-19 response here in DEM. And as you know, between the no KPTZ questions and as we've been talking about moving really from the pandemic phase to the endemic phase, moving away from responding to COVID-19 and now learning to live with and protect ourselves on an ongoing basis from COVID-19. My brief reports are going to be even briefer, I think, from here on out. No vaccine booster clinic updates from me. We continue to push out N95s and KN95s to a variety of locations, and you can continue to find those on the Jefferson County Public Health website. The EOC call center remains available for folks if you have questions, whether they be related to maybe if you have mobility issues and you want to get vaccinated or want your booster doses, we're still willing and able to do home visits. You can call us for that. If you have questions on testing, if you have questions on acquiring a high quality mask, we're available here. That's 344-9791. But otherwise, we're pretty quiet here at the EOC in terms of our COVID-19 response. So not much there. We are planning, as we've talked about internally, beginning our after action review of the response. So we'll be looking backwards over the next couple of months and doing some improvement planning for the next pandemic. As I've mentioned to everyone here in this group, we did what we called our halftime after action review in June of 2020 after the first initial wave, thinking that we'd maybe get another large surge or two, but we could look back approximately halfway through the pandemic, or so we thought at the time. That was a little optimistic, but we're more confident now. Things will hopefully be winding down from this point. So again, not much from me. No KPTZ questions. I'm happy to take KPTZ questions here, but things are thankfully winding down on the response side, and we're just preparing to learning to live with it in the endemic phases of these.
Lily, I had one question regarding, sorry, Kate, do you want to go?
Go ahead. I have a question for Willie when you're done too.
Okay. I'm kind of curious. I need to know more about in prep, I think. My neighborhood's not an in prep neighbor, or I don't know if it's called an in prep neighborhood, but we need to be, you know, and I just think in light of the pandemic, how can kind of community response to large events like a pandemic be folded into in prep preparation? And how can in prep be marketed so that neighborhoods that aren't signed up? I've had a lot of people say, I've heard in California, they do this thing where, you know, you get your neighbor's phone number, a list of your neighbor's phone number. And I'm like, we've got that here, you know? And so I just feel like we need a marketing push on in prep. And also, I'm just curious about how we fold COVID pandemic response into prep stuff, especially with the age of our population in Jefferson County.
So for folks who don't know, MPREP is short for Neighborhood Preparedness, and it's a partnership between DEM and Local 2020 that uses a program called Map Your Neighborhood, which is a nationally recognized program that encourages neighbors helping neighbors after a major disaster. So like you mentioned, Commissioner, it encourages neighbors to knock on each other's doors, get each other's phone numbers, learn each other's names, learn to see if there's something that might represent a disaster vulnerability with that person, if they have mobility issues, if they rely on certain medications, if there's anything a neighbor can do for another neighbor after a major earthquake or during a winter storm or something like that. So during the pandemic, we've relied heavily on our organized NPREP neighborhoods to help push information out through their communities. Recently, when we started distributing high quality masks, we went to our organized NPREP neighborhoods and they conducted a survey of who wanted to receive these high quality masks. And within a little bit less than a week, they had set up 2 distribution events and pushed out about 5,000 masks at these community points of distribution. So all run by volunteers. It's all about neighbors helping neighbors. There's training and a program to support it. And it's going to be really essential for us after a major earthquake. We always preach within the NPREP community, we call it yo-yo, or you're on your own. After a major earthquake, first responder services are going to be so overwhelmed. The neighborhood, they're going to be their own first responders. So we try to instill that sense of empowerment and community with our volunteers. During COVID, we tried to spark NPREP to, if someone in their neighborhood had COVID and was isolating, well, maybe you can rely on your neighbors to help, bring you groceries and check in on you. But what we found was that there was a little bit of shame and that folks didn't want to reach out to their neighbors and say, hey, I have COVID. They kind of wanted to hide that fact. They maybe wanted to rely on more close friends and families rather than their direct neighbors. So what I had initially envisioned MPREP to be doing during this pandemic, we actually had to tweak that a little bit. But regardless, you're absolutely correct. MPREP is a really essential resource for us in emergency management after a major event. A lot of our MPREP leadership, they've had their own issues during the COVID pandemic, or we've reassigned them. We've had them work pretty critical roles in the Emergency Operations Center, so they haven't been able to put as much energy into MPREP as they had historically. So we really are going to be focusing on rejuvenating MPREP, building new neighborhoods, taking the organized neighborhoods we have and helping ramp up that activity. So if you're listening and you either aren't in an organized neighborhood or don't know if your neighborhood's organized and might be interested, don't hesitate to contact us here at DEM. And we can again let you know if you're in a neighborhood or not. And if you're not, give you some information on how to get trained and how to organize your neighborhood and kind of integrate yourself into that MPREP world. Thank you for bringing that up. It's an absolutely critical resource, one that we've leaned on heavily during the pandemic, but one that we need to rebuild back up to get ready for the next disaster coming out of it.
I'm interested in organizing my neighborhood.
Okay.
I'll reach out. Okay.
Perfect. Because you don't have enough on your plate, so this will be good.
Well, it's just my neighborhood, It's really where I spend my time. So,
exactly.
If something was to happen, I would want to be ready to respond. Any other questions for Willie?
I just have a quick one, Willie. Any update on mask availability at pharmacies and grocery stores?
Yep, we restocked all of the grocery stores just this past Friday. We stocked the grocery stores, I believe, earlier in the week, and we'll be making another round there. So we're doing our best to keep them fully stocked, and they've been still going fairly quickly. But again, everything is up on the public health website. They all should have masks. If not, we're making weekly rounds to make sure they're stocked up. So all of our major grocery stores, we did add the food co-op in Port Townsend to the list as of last week. And as I mentioned before, the pharmacies targeted by the federal program are all the major chains. So we've been stocking our smaller local pharmacies here locally out of our state supplies. So I mean, we're moving as fast as we can, updating them every week, pushing out masks. So they'll continue to be there as fast as we can push them out.
Great, thank you. And my question for Dr. Berry can wait till next week.
Are you sure?
Well, you might have to somewhere to be, Dr. Berry.
I can take a stab at it.
Okay. And it might not be a quick answer, but I think a lot of folks missed last week because it was Tuesday instead of Monday. So apologize, we have a hard time getting word out about that. But Dr. Locke did do a little update on the BA2 variant. And I think folks might be curious to hear kind of what is the level of concern about that variant right now.
Sure. So we are monitoring that. It's a sublineage of the Omicron variant. So it is closely related to the one that we have kind of considered the Omicron variant this whole time, the BA1. We are seeing increased prevalence of BA2 in Washington state, but it's still far from the majority of our cases. And we are seeing similar vaccine efficacy for BA1 and BA2. We are seeing likely some transmission advantage of BA2, but we are not seeing increased severity with BA2. So what does that mean for you? That means that basically it's still Omicron. It's still highly transmissible. It can still be quite severe if you're unvaccinated, but it is still much less severe if you are fully vaccinated. And it's unlikely to dramatically change the trajectory of the pandemic at this point. We're still expecting decreases, potentially some slowing of that decrease, which we're actually starting to see at the state level. Some of that is probably BA2. Some of that is parts of our state that have decided to stop wearing masks. And so it's a mix of those things that's playing into those numbers. I don't think that it's cause for significant concern in our community. The same things that work well for original Omicron still work well for BA2. We're also not seeing a significant reinfection from BA1 to BA2. That was one of the concerns, is whether or not recent infection with BA1, the original Omicron, would protect you against BA2, and it does. So similar vaccine protection, and we're not seeing rapid reinfection between the two of them. So that's hopeful as well. All right. Well, thank you so much, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Thank you.